For over 25 years, care teams have relied on Masimo SET measure through motion and low perfusion pulse oximetry to deliver accurate SpO2 readings, even in challenging conditions where other pulse oximeters fail. Visit Masimo.com/SET to discover why SET remains at the heart of patient safety.
Hi, this is Evan Karish, Editor-in-Chief of Anesthesiology, and I've got some highlights for you from the December 2021 issue that were selected by the journal editors. In this month's podcast, we're going to be exploring new information about how anesthesiologists can influence the carbon footprint of the operating room. We'll also look at the hot topic of treatments for critically ill COVID-19 patients. And we'll examine whether a paravertebral block can possibly reduce pain in breast surgery patients. And we'll close this month with two review articles. One of them takes on the topic of infection prevention in the intensive care unit, and the other addresses the challenges of managing neurocognitive disorders. Let's begin this month with a prospective study of the carbon footprint that is associated with total knee replacements. Healthcare produces greenhouse gases, both directly and indirectly. A previous study of hospitals in the United Kingdom and the United States and Canada suggested that anesthesia could have greater carbon dioxide equivalent emissions than all surgical equipment and all operating room associated energy requirements. Understanding how carbon dioxide equivalent emissions happen in the operating room can help anesthesiologists monitor and hopefully reduce workplace carbon footprints. Dr. Forbes McGann of the University of Melbourne in Australia and his colleagues collected data on 29 patients who underwent total knee replacements at a single center. Of these patients, 9 had general anesthesia, 10 had spinal anesthesia, and 10 had a combined spinal and general anesthetic. The investigators evaluated carbon dioxide equivalent emissions, also known as CO2 emissions. The CO2 emissions were similar across the groups. They averaged 15 kilograms for spinal anesthesia, 17 kilograms for general anesthesia, and 18 kilograms for combined spinal and general anesthesia. The major sources of CO2 emissions across all of the groups were single-use items. These included things like electricity for patient air warmers and pharmaceuticals, other than anesthetic gases. The single-use item categories accounted for about 16%, 25%, and 8% of total CO2 emissions in the groups having spinal anesthesia, general anesthesia, and combined spinal and general anesthesia. In the general anesthesia and combined anesthesia groups, use of a volatile anesthetic, in this case sevoflurane, contributed 32 and 17% of the total CO2 emissions. In the spinal and combined anesthesia groups, washing and sterilizing reusable items contributed to 29 and 24% of the CO2 emissions. The authors also found that oxygen use in spinal anesthesia was a significant contributor of carbon dioxide emissions, with higher flow rates than the general and combined approaches. The study was small and limited to a single center, but the authors encouraged clinicians to be mindful of their carbon footprints and seek ways, however small, to reduce the carbon footprint. There is an editorial that accompanied by this article. The editorial was written by Dr. Michelle Streis and Matthew Eckelman. The editorial emphasized that the study does not provide a definitive answer on which anesthesia method is the least environmentally friendly, but they noted some practical takeaway messages, such as potentially using minimal fresh gas flows, to optimize inhaled anesthetic consumption when possible. The other interesting aspect is the cover photo on the December issue of Anesthesiology, which addresses the issue of carbon footprint and waste. It's beautiful and magnificently tells the story. Check out the full article for free in this month's issue and the cover of this month's Anesthesiology. Next, we're going to look at a clinical trial that examined anesthetic depth and the occurrence of postoperative delirium. Some previous studies suggested that reducing the depth of anesthesia might reduce the risk of delirium, but results of many studies have been very inconsistent. In addition, many studies have involved general anesthesia or in patients who were cognitively impaired. Dr. Charles Brown of Johns Hopkins University and his team sought to compare the incidence of postoperative delirium in patients who received sedation based on targeted bispectral index values compared to patients receiving general anesthesia. The authors randomized 217 patients who were 65 years or older and who were undergoing lumbar spine fusion to receive either spinal anesthesia with targeted sedation to a BIS score of greater than 60 to 70, or to general anesthesia where the anesthesiologist did not see the BIS readings. The primary outcome was delirium during the first 3 days after surgery, and this was assessed using the standard confusion assessment method. Based on this metric, the authors found no difference in the incidence of delirium between the two anesthetic groups. In addition, most subgroup analyses, including age and baseline comorbidities, also showed no differences in delirium between the sedation and general anesthesia groups. The exception was patients with baseline scores of less than 27 on the mini mental status exam, who showed less delirium if given spinal anesthesia compared to general anesthesia. In an accompanying editorial, Drs. Pratik Peripandi and Elizabeth Whitlock and Christopher Hughes noted that these reported study results supported previous work showing no impact of depth of anesthesia on delirium outcomes. They speculated whether efforts to reduce delirium might focus on targeted interventions for patients with known modifiable risk factors. This article is available for free in this month's issue. Our next clinical study focuses on pulmonary function after surgery. It evaluated the effects of different ventilator approaches during emergence from anesthesia on pulmonary outcomes. It compared pressure support mechanical ventilation versus spontaneous ventilation during emergence on postoperative atelectasis. Pressure support ventilation had become widely used for weaning patients from mechanical ventilation in the ICU, but had not been well studied in the setting of operating room anesthesia. Dr. Heejun Jong of Sung Kyung Kwan University School of Medicine in Seoul, South Korea, and colleagues tested the hypothesis that pressure support would result in less postoperative atelectasis in adults undergoing laparoscopic surgery. The investigators randomized 100 patients who underwent either laparoscopic colectomy or robot-assisted prostatectomy. Half the patients underwent pressure support mechanical ventilation, and the other half underwent spontaneous ventilation with intermittent manual assistance on emergence, which averaged 8 to 9 minutes. The determination of atelectasis was based on lung ultrasonography in the post-anesthesia care unit. The study found that the incidence of postoperative atelectasis was 33% in patients who had pressure support compared to 57% in those who had spontaneous ventilation during anesthesia emergence. And this difference was statistically significant. In the recovery unit, the PO2 in the pressure support group was higher than in the spontaneous ventilation group. But the incidence of oxygen desaturation during the 48 hours postoperatively was not different between the groups. The authors noted that the study was limited to patients at low risk for atelectasis, but the results were consistent with previous studies. In an accompanying editorial, Drs. Luca Bigatello and Erland Ostberg noted that interventions to prevent atelectasis during and after emergence from anesthesia are worth pursuing. Although the current study showed no significant impact of pressure support on oxygen saturation or other clinical outcomes, it did show the importance of consistent positive pressure during anesthesia emergence. The authors added that more clinical evidence is needed, as is a standardized scoring system for lung ultrasound and atelectasis for improved evaluation. You can access this article for free in this month's issue. Now, let's turn to a prospective study that explored whether paravertebral block could prevent chronic pain in breast surgery patients. We know that postoperative chronic pain has a significant impact on quality of life and recovery for many breast surgery patients, and clinicians continue to seek ways to manage it and ideally prevent it. Previous studies have shown reductions in chronic pain after the use of paravertebral blocks, but the data remain quite limited. Dr. Aileen Albifeldzer of PSL Research University in St. Cloud, France, and colleagues conducted a multicenter, randomized, placebo-controlled trial of women who were undergoing partial or complete mastectomy, either with or without lymph node dissection. They randomized 178 patients to ropivacaine and 174 to saline. After 3 months, chronic pain was similar between the groups, 52% in the paravertebral block group and 48% in the sham or control group. No significant differences in pain were noted at 6 months or at 12 months in addition. The authors noted that their findings were in line with some previous studies, but not others. They added that paravertebral block may be sufficient for a pain control immediately after breast surgery, but it fails to block the supraclavicular nerves, pectoral nerves, or other brachial plexus branches. This article is available for free in this month's issue. We next move to the hot topic of COVID-19 with a look at a one-year retrospective study of more than 2,000 COVID-19 patients. Although over the course of time, overall treatment strategies for critically ill COVID-19 patients have evolved and have improved, the mortality from COVID-19 remains unfortunately high. Clinicians continue to work to identify treatments that are associated with lower mortality. Dr. Xu Zhao of Yale University led a team in examining the records of hospitalized COVID-19 patients who were 18 years and older, who were admitted to ICUs at 6 hospitals in Connecticut. The study period was February 2020 to March 2021. The authors reviewed 23 treatments for COVID. These included antiviral drugs, anticoagulants, antiplatelet agents, steroids, immunomodulators, immunosuppressants, vasopressors, and various other uncategorized drugs, such as azithromycin. The primary outcome of the study was in-hospital mortality, which overall averaged 29%. After multivariate analysis followed by multiple testing correlations and corrections, the authors found that apixaban or aspirin were associated with significantly lower mortality than patients who did not receive these drugs. The authors also conducted a propensity score matching analysis. Patients treated with apixaban and aspirin still showed lower mortality rates compared to patients who did not receive these drugs. Propensity score matching analysis showed lesser mortality for patients treated with enoxaparin, which was the anticoagulant of choice in the study population. Both prophylactic and therapeutic doses of enoxaparin were associated with lower mortality. The authors note that the results may not be applicable to future cases because of variables such as viral mutations and changes in vulnerable populations, and of course, the approach to COVID-19 continues to evolve and change. But the authors also added that optimization of exact dosage, timing, and the duration of any of the treatments for COVID-19 still require intensive and additional study. This article is available for free in this month's issue. Next, we turn to an exploratory analysis of inhaled anesthetic elimination in an animal model. This is a sophisticated laboratory study. Although inhaled anesthetic uptake has been well studied, elimination has really not been well studied, despite its potential importance to everyday clinical anesthesia practice. Dr. James Baumgartner of the University of Pittsburgh and colleagues developed a mathematical model of anesthetic elimination to show how washout kinetics of volatile anesthetics depend on the lung ventilation to perfusion ratio. The authors found that the global ventilation to perfusion ratio modifies the time constant for tissue anesthetic washout throughout the entire phase of anesthetic elimination. And they found that the fractional clearance of anesthetic by normal lungs quickly becomes constant following a short and swift initial decline in the alveolar anesthetic partial pressure. The author's model also showed that when incomplete lung clearance slows anesthetic washout, this process is more pronounced at lower ventilation to perfusion ratios. The author stated that understanding of anesthetic elimination may be as valuable in the clinical practice as understanding anesthetic uptake, in part because the lack of options for speeding up volatile anesthetic elimination. Our clinical focus review this month addresses the perpetual challenges of infection prevention in the intensive care unit. Healthcare-associated infections affect nearly one-third of ICU patients in higher-income countries, according to lead author Dr. Michael Mazzeffi of George Washington University. The review included four evidence-based strategies for reducing ICU infections. This started with the appropriate perioperative antibiotic prophylaxis. The article highlighted data suggesting that the routine antibiotic prophylaxis should not be continued beyond 24 hours in the absence of a suspected infection. The article next emphasized the importance of hand hygiene and transmission-based precautions as per current CDC guidance. Contact transmission remains the most common source of healthcare-associated infections in the ICU. However, such transmission of infections can be limited by strategies including hand hygiene, use of single-patient rooms, the proper use of personal protective equipment and disposable medical equipment, and proper disinfection of rooms between patients. Other areas where quality improvement can reduce infections include management of ventilator-associated pneumonia, central line-associated bloodstream infections, and Clostridium difficile infections. The article concludes that healthcare-associated infection prevention represents an opportunity for anesthesiologists to take the lead in efforts for quality improvement, policy development, and research. Our last article to talk about this month is a review article on the topic of sleep, pain, and cognition, and their influence on perioperative neurocognitive disorders. The prevention of perioperative neurocognitive disorders is a priority, particularly for older patients. Data have shown that approximately half of older patients experience postoperative delirium, according to the author, Dr. Brian O'Gara of Harvard Medical School. Dr. O'Gara and colleagues discuss the value of multi-component interventions in preventing postoperative delirium and other postoperative neurocognitive issues. The targets of such a multi-component intervention are sleep, pain, and cognition. Sleep and sleep disturbances are important risk factors for neurodegenerative diseases, but the extent and nature and timing of their impact remain unclear. Chronic sleep patterns, environmental issues, and other sleep factors overlap with pain and cognition. The relationship between pain and perioperative neurocognitive disorders is a complicated one. The link between pain and inflammation may play a role in the development of perioperative neurocognitive disorders if inflammation of the peripheral or central nervous system ultimately leads to neuronal injury and brain dysfunction. The article also notes the link between cholinergic neurons and pain signals, and that cholinergic deficiency has been implicated in pain hypersensitivity and in delirium. The author adds that preoperative pain should be considered as well. And finally, the article discusses efforts to promote the best possible functional recovery, including cognitive recovery, for patients by so-called prehabilitation, that is, things in the form of physical and nutritional and psychological help. These strategies may take the form of home-based exercise or dietary counseling. The article also cites the use of postoperative cognitive training to prevent perioperative neurocognitive disorders, but also admits that high-quality evidence is lacking. The article concludes with the admonition that we need to better identify high-risk patients and choose the most effective interventions and care plans. If you're interested in learning more about submitting manuscripts to anesthesiology, please visit our new author submission advice page. This is on the journal website, anesthesiology.org. This submission resource offers insights into our editor's expectations and a blueprint for creating more successful manuscripts. As 2021 draws to a close, I hope that all of you continue to stay engaged and explore the latest topics in our diverse field. You can always find new studies and commentary on the journal website, www.pubs.asahq.org/anesthesiology. As always, thank you for listening to this podcast, and thank you for your support of anesthesiology. I hope that you find the information that we present to help you guide and improve your clinical practice. And I look forward to sharing more important research with you next month in 2022.
Discover the difference with Masimo SET Pulse Oximetry. Since its introduction in 1995, Masimo SET has been shown in over 100 independent and objective studies to outperform other pulse oximetry technologies. Visit Masimo.com/SET to learn why SET is trusted by healthcare providers all over the world.